Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Institute for Nonpartisan Research and Civic Engagement at Shippensburg University. Please visit us at connorsinstitute.org to sign up for our free email newsletter. While you are there, also be sure to check out all of our great research and resources.
Please listen carefully. Carefully.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the program. This is the Utterly Moderate Podcast, and I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. Thank you so much for joining us on another episode. On today's show, we're going to be discussing two big gender-related stories that have been making the rounds in the news. And to do that, I'm joined by a good friend of mine. He's actually the co-author on my upcoming book, The Poisoning of the American Mind, Jake Mackey from Occidental College. Jake, thanks so much for joining us again, my friend.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
How you doing? How's your semester going?
It's going. It's fine. You know, yeah. The less said, the better.
we're coming out of winter here, and so, but you're in LA, so you're just coming out of what, like mild temperatures to hotter temperatures?
Mild temperatures, but lots of rain, and that's been really nice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you guys are usually worried about drought and that kind of stuff,
usually
right?
Drying up and blowing away, yeah, or catching fire.
Well, we're going to talk about a few things today, which is why I have you on. A few stories related to gender, one positive and one not so positive. So I think we should start. Let's start with the positive. What do you say?
Mm-hmm. I think it's great. There's this meta-analysis out that looks at audit studies and from 1976 to very recently, was it 2020?
Yeah.
And finds that since 2009, in effect, the one line summation is that there has been no gender bias, no sex-based discrimination in callbacks to job applicants. So in other words, employers are not comparing two equally qualified candidates and preferentially calling the male as opposed to the female. And that's great news.
Yeah. So, and we covered this in the Connors newsletter. So if you go to connorsinstitute.org, you can read about it there. We ran a piece by Lee Jussum, who's a psychologist at Rutgers University. He described what happened. So yeah, as Jake said, it's a meta-analysis. So it's not just one study, but it's an analysis of many studies, 85 in fact, including over 360,000 job applications between 76 and 2020. And so let's break down a few of the concepts here. So a meta-analysis is much better than a single study because it makes sure that many studies are confirming the same thing, right? Not just one outlier.
Absolutely. It's the gold standard, you know, it's the way to discover truth in social science, and other sciences,
Yeah, and if you want to say sort of what the consensus is in a field, that's the best way to do it is to, and it's not just an average of the studies, so you do kind of see, and again, this is 85 studies, you do see what the trend is among the studies, but you also will weight studies that are methodologically stronger, heavier, and then ones that aren't weaker. You'll look for not just whether there's an association, but something called effect sizes. So, you know, if I find some treatment causes something to happen, but it only reduces the likelihood by 0.1% or something, well, that's great, but the effect size is very, very small. And so it takes mm-hmm. that into account as well. And yeah, so as Jake said, so not a shock, prior to 2009, it wasn't substantial, but there was some discrimination in the labor market. And what they found since 2009, they're finding today, is not only on average are women not penalized compared to men, equally qualified women compared to men, but they actually received a slight preference, right?
Yeah, and I think, so the preference is, there's an overall, is I think it's 9% preference. But the where that comes from is that women are preferred in jobs that are traditionally, have a traditional sort of female coding to them, you know, that are sort of seen as the kind of jobs women do. Whereas in jobs that are either sort of sex neutral, there's no sort of cultural conception that this is man's work, this is a woman's work, or jobs that are, have been coded traditionally male, in those jobs, there's apparently no discrimination one way or another. But I think where that overall 9% comes from is from these jobs that are traditionally coded as sort of women's types of jobs. And those are going still sort of, there's kind of anti-male discrimination in the callbacks on those jobs. And that's actually a funny thing. You could see it as either anti-male discrimination, or you could see it as a sort of sexist stereotype about the type of work women do, right? That, you know, the people who are doing the hiring for these jobs that are traditionally sort of feminine, you know, women's jobs, they say, you know, they're thinking to themselves, well, we need to hire a woman for this position because this is women's work. And that in itself is a kind of sexist stereotype. You know? But I don't know that. I'm just, you know, inferring, right, what
sure,
might be going
sure.
on. Yeah.
And we should talk about the types of studies they're talking about. So the strengths and the limitations. So an audit study is one of the best studies you can use to look at discrimination, because a lot of studies, especially in like my field and a variety of others, they try to compare, they use like multiple regression analysis or something like that. And they try to control for every possible variable you can control for. And when they find that there's still some unexplained gap between groups, then they sort of attribute that to discrimination. Well, there's all sorts of problems with that. One of which is you can't control for everything in the social world. And so an experiment, you actually go out and see how people are actually treated. You don't just sort of make a inference from, you know, your statistics or whatever. You actually go out and see how people are really treated, and you keep the applications for the jobs equivalent. So they have very, very similar qualifications. You just change one thing in an experiment, the one thing you want to see, if that's the way that they're filtering out, you know, certain applicants. And so you have males and females applying for jobs. And the strength is, again, it's happening in the real world. You're seeing how people are actually acting, not how they say they act on surveys, not sort of inferring from, you know, statistics, that kind of stuff. Now, one of the limitations is you can't really do a lot of this stuff past the hiring process. So it would be unethical. You'd take up a lot of companies' time and resources, and it's just very difficult to see, okay, once people get hired, do they get discriminated in promotions and you know, how they're treated and mentored and all that kind of stuff. So that's still an open question, and that's a limitation. But the strength is, at least when it comes to the hiring part of this process, it's a really, really strong experimental design, right?
It seems that way to me, yeah. And you're absolutely right that, you know, once you get past that process, which may be heavily curated by HR and a team of lawyers who are making sure that it's compliant with this and that law, you don't know what happens at, you know, you can't really, beyond anecdotes and collecting stories, you don't know what happens after that. You can't study that in the same systematic way. And so, yeah, once a woman gets hired, she may be subject to all sorts of gendered discrimination that is just not picked up in this. So, yeah, but it's still, we shouldn't discount how great the news is because of these hypothetical unknowns.
Yeah. Oh, it's really good news for this particular aspect, right? Yeah. And you can try to extrapolate and generalize to other parts of the work experience, but at least in mm-hmm. this part of the process, it's good news. I mm-hmm. did find one really funny part of the study, which I know you'll find funny because you and I write books about this topic, but in one part of the study, they asked academics, who should know better, to predict, not predict the future, but to predict how people are actually treated. Because these studies have already been conducted, so they should know these studies, and they should be teaching them in their classrooms, and they should be citing them in their research. And let me pull up Lee Jussum. He's a psychologist at Rutgers, and he wrote a piece, and it was featured in the Connors newsletter. And so here's what he had to say about it. Quote, "The research team also had both lay people and academics predict the results of their meta-analysis. All vastly overestimated the amount of bias favoring men and erroneously predicted that the bias persisted into the present, although lay people were somewhat more inaccurate than were academics. The overestimates were dramatic, with lay people estimating that men are 3 times more likely to be called back than women, even in the most recent period they studied. Academics were not quite as bad, but still plenty awful, given that their credentials should confer some higher level of knowledge about these sorts of things. Academics estimated that men were twice as likely as women to be called back for jobs in the 2009 to 2020 period. For both groups, the overestimates were more extreme the further back they went," end quote. So not only did academics overestimate the amount of bias, but in the wrong direction, Jake. So when you saw that, knowing what you know about our industry, what'd you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, academics are fallible too, right? And, you know,
me and you included.
Of course. Probably, you know, certainly me more than most, I would say. One of the reasons you do a meta-analysis is because not everyone can be expected to have synthesized the results of dozens of totally independent studies in their own minds, right? It's actually hard to change your world picture, you know? So you get a data point here and a data point there and a data point there that suggest maybe your world picture needs revision. But it's really not until you get these kind of meta-analyses that you have a really compelling reason to change your worldview, you know? And I think a lot of academics, I'm defending academics here. I think a lot of academics with reason have had a kind of baseline assumption that there's a gender discrimination in the workplace in hiring, you know? And it's not an unreasonable thing, especially if we're talking, what is the average age of these academics that were polled, you know?
Sure, sure.
Like my mom is still a philosophy professor. She's in her 70s. She knows from firsthand experience, you know, the kind of gender, the kind of discrimination women faced. When she was beginning her career, she was told she shouldn't try to be a doctor because women aren't doctors.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. You know, so what is it going to take for her to revise her worldview? And then people like her have been teaching younger generations what the sort of baseline is, right? And so it would make sense then if millennial professors also had the same misperception now. I'm being very like charitable to academics here, and I'm positing that studies like this will move the baseline assumption, and we will all, because we're all rational and responsive to evidence, we will all shift our, don't laugh, we will all shift our baseline assumptions, and we will change our sort of worldviews to accommodate this.
There probably will be a lag time, I think. there will certainly be a lag. I mean, we'll see how it goes. You're more positive and optimistic than I am about it, but
I'm trying to give the best. I also think there are some people who will flatly reject and others who will simply ignore this, and they will continue with the narrative that works for them. And, I think that'll happen too.
Yeah. You know, despite the negatives of people and people who should know better getting it wrong, it is really good news. And again, it has limitations. So, you know, whether you experience harassment, discrimination, you know, whether that occurs in mentoring and just everyday experience and promotions, you know, the glass ceiling, all that kind of stuff, that's still a fair question. And this study cannot answer that, right? So don't draw those conclusions. But at least when it comes to this particular part of the process, you know, the 1980s and 1970s were a very different world. And it seems like we've made a lot of progress. And that should be something to cheer for, I think.
For someone like me who has a daughter who's 10 years old, I cannot be happier to hear this. You know, it means that her chances of, you know, we already know she's got great chances in with college and education, right? She's as a woman, she'll be far more likely than her male peers to get a BA, far more likely than her male peers to get a PhD or other higher degree. And but now it's also great to know that she's not going to face some kind of gatekeeping just based on the fact that she's a woman when she applies, even for jobs that have been stereotypically coded as, you know, male. That's great for me as a dad. I'm glad. I'm so happy her life is going to be free of what my mother faced.
Absolutely. So that's good news. And we started off with some positive. And now we're going to shift to some negative in the back end of this conversation. And we've covered a lot of the issues that we're going to talk about here on this podcast recently, and we're not trying to keep hammering this point, but right after the conversation with Lisa Sellin Davis was published, this new report came out. And so it's important to talk about. It's disturbing. It's not definitive. It suggests some problems. We're going to need more investigation. And so we'll see where this leads. But at least on the surface, it appears that some things that have been said publicly are not being said privately. So let me outline what's happening here. And then Jake, you can give your input. But so some internal documents from WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, were obtained by an organization called Environmental Progress. And these internal documents show that members of WPATH, which is a leading global organization advocating for transgender health, admitted privately a variety of things. They admitted that youth gender interventions are largely experimental and that the evidence isn't really in, which is troubling because that's, it wouldn't be troubling if they had said that publicly, right? But so let's just start there, Jake. I mean, it's one thing if you're saying publicly and you're telling patients that this is experimental. It could go well. It could not go well. Here's the risks. But a lot of what they do in their public-facing communication really contradicts this. You know, this is settled science. It's all evidence-based. So what was your reaction to that part of these revelations?
Yeah. Can I just back up one second before I say that?
Yeah, of course.
I think it's important to note that my Environmental Progress is an organization, I believe, a nonprofit organization that was founded by Michael Schellenberger, who is an apostate from the sort of alarmist environmentalism movement. He was an environmental activist when in his younger days, and then he had a kind of come to Jesus moment where he said that this alarmism is going over the top. It's going beyond the evidence, and we need a more a less sort of extreme response to the challenges we do face. It's his, that's his organization. Now he's the guy who also leaked the Twitter files were leaked to him among others. So these WPATH files then were leaked to him as well, and he delegated to one of his to someone who works there with him, Mia Hughes, the assimilation and reading and assessment of these files. And yeah, they're really quite striking, aren't they? Let me say before I say anything about what was revealed in the files that just I do think trans is an absolutely real thing. I've known trans people for more than 30 years. It's clearly, there's a lot of the discourse right now is trying to sort of insinuate that the whole thing is maybe some kind of crazy fad or some kind of communist plot or something. You know, you get these kind of extreme.
It's always the communists. There. Yeah.
It's always the Marxists and the communists. Yeah. But no, I mean, this is, to me, it's just so obvious that this is a real thing. and we people with you know, who are trans, they deserve all the same sort of human dignity and human rights that everyone else does, and they deserve good medical care. Now, what's the problem with the WPATH files? Well, like you said, it indicates that unlike their sort of public-facing comments, within the world of transgender medicine, and especially troubling transgender medicine as practiced on minors, that there's actually a lot of recognition that these treatments are often experimental, or the outcomes from them are not well known. And yet, you know, they continue to put on this face that, oh, this is the best evidenced medicine. We know exactly what we're doing. You're in good hands. Have no doubts. I would think any parent or any adolescent who's going through gender dysphoria would want to take a long, hard look at the sort of things that have been revealed in these files and ask, am I getting the absolute best, most careful care available, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, so to your point about the public facing comments, and by the way, I mean, yeah, there's many medical organizations around the world that rely on the guidance from WPATH. So this is not just some outlier organization. So this is from the head of WPATH, Marcy Bowers, quote, "WPATH is and always has been a science and evidence-based organization whose recommendations are widely endorsed by major medical organizations around the world," end quote. Now, the first part, I think they internally they're showing is not the case, that you know, it's their solid long-term evidence and evidence, you know, science and evidence-based findings. But the second part is true. I mean, they are, there's a number of organizations around the world that rely on them. Here's another quote. They say, quote, this is from Marcy Bowers, "We are the professionals who best know the medical needs of trans and gender diverse individuals and stand opposed to individuals who misrepresent and delegitimize the diverse identities and complex needs of this population through scare tactics. The world is not flat. Gender, like genitalia, is represented by diversity. The small percentage of the population that is trans or gender diverse deserves health care and will never be a threat to the global gender binary," end quote. So again, they're glossing over a lot of stuff that if they truly believed would be one thing, but these internal documents show that a lot of what they're saying there, they don't believe in person. Not that they completely reject it, but that they know that we're far from a settled science on this.
Yeah, they're acknowledging much more uncertainty about these treatments in private than they do in public. And that's just a frightening thing. If you have a child who has gender dysphoria and is, you know, being seen by a physician who's following these guidelines, which, you know, they are asserted as like objective and clear, and they are endorsed by all these, you know, all these world, all these health organizations all around the world. And that lends it this veneer of just unquestionability. And I've encountered this too, talking to people myself. They'll say, "What are you talking about that there's any doubt that puberty blockers are just fine? You know, go look at the Mayo Clinic website. It says they're just fine for kids, you know?" And the Mayo Clinic website and WPATH, they completely gloss over the potential health impacts of starting a child on puberty blockers. You know, that's just a for instance, right?
Well, yeah, and you know, look, if they're saying these things publicly and they have doubts privately, but this is the guidance they're giving these organizations, then these organizations are then doing a poor job of when they're describing this to their patients and their parents, of giving them the full details that they need, right, to make these decisions for informed consent. And that brings up another issue that these files reveal, which is internally, at least, they are very cognizant of the extremely thorny issue of informed consent from a minor, you know, whether they can truly understand. And one of the quotes was something to the effect of, "How can we get informed consent from people who haven't taken high school biology yet," or something like that. I mean, you know, really thorny issues. Marcy Bowers admits that there's huge issues with sexual function and inability to climax and that kind of stuff. And, you know, the idea that a child can understand that when the evidence isn't in on a lot of this stuff and they can understand the kinds of decisions they're making, mm-hmm. really troubling. And it's not just me or some other critic that's recognizing that. It's WPATH that's recognizing it.
Yeah. It's the people, you know, in this very field of medicine. Not only do they acknowledge that there's problems with, you know, minors giving informed consent. I mean, this is a basic ethical issue. They acknowledge it in some cases about parents too, right? That there are some cases where they could, you know, a clinician could tell they had a parent who is maybe illiterate, who was not able to just internalize and assess the information being given, and yet was signing off on procedures that would turn their child into potentially a lifelong medical patient, you know? So it's, it just seems clear to me from this that there's a dramatic need for some serious ethical oversight in the way that this is practiced, this medicine is practiced with minors. That would be my minimal takeaway here, is that there's some kind of need for some serious ethical oversight. Yeah.
And there's many European countries have hit the brakes on all of this because of these concerns. And I'm in such a weird position with this because, as you said, you talk to people on our side, you know, on the left side of the fence, and any objection they really truly believe is just a right-wing smear tactic. And I have to be very, very clear, and I'm not sure this ever breaks through, but I don't want to grant any power to people on the right side of the aisle who want to hurt trans people. That's not what I want to do in any way, shape, or form. But
agreed.
So that's just a starting point. That's just a non-starter to give those people any power. Okay. Mm-hmm. But on our side of the fence, you know, people who actually are trying to do the best they can for this population, I'm not sure we're doing the best that we can.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's a problem.
Yeah, there's what I've encountered. This is just, you know, anecdotal, but what I've encountered is just a cavalier writing off of the concerns, you know, and we're talking about children we're talking about subjecting them to medical treatments that will have lifelong effects on them and that may, again, I said it before, turn them into lifelong medical patients when there's nothing, they're not sick, they don't have like cancer, you know? So the cavalier sort of writing off of that on our side, I think, needs to be resisted just as much as the genuinely anti-trans bigotry coming from the right. You know, because we're talking about kids, we're talking about vulnerable kids who are going through some kind of crisis where they're having a gender dysphoric experience. They're having a sense of not being at home in their body. We need to tread very carefully with these kids, I think.
Well, Jake, I always appreciate having you on. Could talk to you for hours about this stuff, and was glad to have some good news to share today in the area of gender and some news that's concerning and needs certainly more investigation. But anyhow, my friend, we've got a book coming out this summer and we'll be talking about that then. Anything you want to say before you get out of here?
Yeah, can I actually say, I think these WPATH files are ultimately good news in the sense that I think it's going to become harder and harder for the people that we were just talking about, people on sort of our side of the aisle, it's going to become harder and harder for them to ignore the very real problems that are here. And I think it's going to become harder for these health organizations to ignore these problems. And I think more and more organizations are going to be joining countries like Finland and Sweden and the UK in reassessing and putting some brakes on some of the more out there treatments, some of the more radical, careless treatments. And so I think that's ultimately gotta be, in the end, good news, right?
You know what? Actually, you know, I love the fact that you put a positive spin on this before we leave, but I do have to say, now that I think about it, it's a negative story, but I think it will have positive results, which is the kids we want to get the best outcomes. Hopefully we'll be having better outcomes because of this. So yeah, that is good news in the end. So, all right, Jake, well, thanks for putting a positive spin on my pessimistic take on everything in the world. So,
that's what I'm here for.
Until next time, Jake. And again, we got a book coming out this summer, which we'll talk about, but we'll save that for down the road. So, have a good one, my friend.
Thank you, Lawrence. It's great talking as always. Take care.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Again.
Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.